so pleased this evening that we can move on to our program. And I'm delighted to have with me, as my first guest this evening, Aroha Mead. Aroha is a researcher in Mātauranga Māori and in Indigenous knowledge. And I did catch a glimpse of a wānanga that was it a wānanga or a symposium that was held over the weekend, starting Friday, and I think it went through the weekend. He whenua rono, Indigenous Seed, Soil and Food Symposium. And I did see where Dr. Vandana Shiva was one of the speakers, and I've often seen her, some clips of her, and I love what she has to say on Facebook. But anyway, to tell us a little bit about the symposium, and it was very wide-ranging, actually, when I look at the program, is Dr. Aroha, or Professor, or Doctor, Dr. Aroha Meads. Kia ora, Aroha. Nice to have you on Radio Wātea this evening.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me. And no, I'm not a doctor. I'm just plain Aroha te Pariake Mead.
Plain Aroha. There's nothing plain about you, my dear. But thank you. Thank you for coming on, Aroha. And look, the symposium was really interesting. So how did you find it?
You can go to a lot of events and a lot of conferences and you can hear a lot of people speak and you go, oh, that's very nice. And then you go home and you carry on your life as if nothing ever happened. And then very rarely there are times when you go to a conference or you hear someone speak and it really hits you. And that's how I felt about this conference. It just absolutely warmed my heart to see full capacity for a conference about our land, about Indigenous foods and seeds, and taking greater control of our lives through nutrition and through growing our own food. Just an amazing caliber of speakers, and Dr. Vandana Shiva is absolutely inspirational. So I'd have to rank this as one of my top conferences for at least the past 3-4 years. And hats off to Dr. Jessica Hutchings and her team for organising it.
Well, I think it's very timely, Aroha, because, you know, when you look around the world now, people are very concerned about biodiversity, about food security, and also where our culture and our heritage, what part does that play? Because we're seeing, I suppose you could say, patents being put over food supply chains, and you know, and people are getting anxious now. They're getting really anxious if they never were before. I think because it's being talked about. The symposium was another area of opportunity for people to become informed. So I think people really want to know not only what's in store, but what can they do?
Absolutely. I think if you look at what's going on at the global level in terms of the research that's been undertaken about the state of the world's biodiversity, there's been a huge global assessment through the IPBES, which is the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And in that assessment, they concluded that although there have been a damage to the environment over the years, nothing eclipsed the scale of the past 50 years, which means that in our lifetime, this generation is actually responsible for the greatest scale of destruction of biodiversity. But what the report also showed is that although there is deterioration of biodiversity across the world, every country without exception, in those areas that are owned and maintained by Indigenous peoples, the scale of decline is far less. So that's a pretty powerful message for the world to be told about not only the state of the environment, but the potential to learn from good custodians and to try and adapt some of those those processes and approaches to a wider scale.
Well, I find that interesting, Aroha, because could that mean that those countries, and particularly those areas, perhaps in certain countries where there is a significant indigenous population, and biodiversity hasn't been as harmed as in other places, would that mean that perhaps those areas they might be looked at by governments or by big corporates? And who might say, well, we could go in there and do something, and which we know would probably be harmful. But is there potential that those areas could be, not vulnerable, what's the word I'm looking for, could perhaps be targeted?
That's always a possibility in a world where greed is allowed to manifest itself. But one of the other things that's been happening at the global level, and again through the same network, is they did another global assessment on diverse values and valuation of nature, where they looked at the fact that there are over 50 different ways that are used around the world by peoples and governments to value the interrelationship between humans and nature. And what we've seen is that there's one particular value system that has dominated globally, and that's a capitalist model value system, an economic system, and that system has been to the detriment of both the well-being of the environment and the well-being of people. So we also can learn from this, as if we don't know it already, that we need to have a better model for our interrelationship with nature. We need to stop relying just on economic analysis and look at, the strengthening our relationship with nature. And that was one of the themes of the conference. And all the way through, all the speakers were kind of stressing that point, that we need a different value system, and that the value system that we've been operating under has just done a lot of damage, and it's just not sustainable, and it's not the future.
Well, that would be right, and it's come from that colonial thinking, I suppose, but it must be extremely difficult to shake off a system that has embedded itself, I guess, in the capitalist system in most countries around the world, because that seems to be the currency, doesn't it, these days?
Yeah, but you can see this interesting dynamic playing out around the world. Well, I think everybody actually knows that our current system is unsustainable. But it's about whether you, out of fear, hold on to it desperately because your mind can't think of any other possibility. Yeah. Or else you just don't give a damn and about the damage that's caused, then you're so embedded in the value system that the pursuit of money is the only way that you know how to analyze things, or you change. And you can see that in some countries they make bold decisions in their elections, and they get a very innovative head of state who comes in and starts the process of change. And then all the old guard gets really nervous and then they come back in again because they don't want to let go. I kind of feel that's what's happened in New Zealand, that we have, like, the old guard can see that this model is on its way out and they're desperately trying to hold on to it. But it's almost a fruitless exercise.
And I think you actually are right. When I look at what the current government is doing, and it seems to me that they are quite desperate, And well, that's my view of it anyway. When I see, but I don't think we can. Certainly, I don't believe we can afford to go backwards. So it just means that we've got to keep our eye on the ball. And the other thing that I was interested to read about was the free trade agreements. They came up for quite a bit of discussion, did they?
Yes, we had quite a number of speakers talking about free trade agreements. We had Annette Sykes, Jane Kelsey, Jessica Hutchings, myself, and the keynote, Vandana Shiva, because free trade agreements have an impact on people's daily lives to a far greater extent than many realize. It's a difficult area to get your head around. It's a difficult area to get accurate information about, because a lot of these free trade agreements are negotiated behind closed doors. And we tend to hear about them after the fact, after they've been signed. And only then do you learn what has been given away through the signing of a free trade agreement. So one of the key co-sponsors of the He Whenua Rongo conference was Ngātoki Whakaruruanga, and they have come about through the mediated agreement between government and the claimants of the Y2522 claim, which was taken to the Waitangi Tribunal about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Mm-hmm. But because of that claim, that an agreement was reached and this group was set up, and the whole idea is to ensure that Te Tiriti is honoured in a very practical and obvious way through these trade treaties, that rights, hard-fought rights of Māori aren't eroded through the signing of these free trade agreements. So that was pretty much every speaker actually had something to say about the impact of these agreements, because they often include clauses on intellectual property rights, clauses about ensuring that foreign companies have full access to all resources within New Zealand or within the country that the agreement is signed with. And they're far more comprehensive than most people would realise.
Yes, and I think that I think you're quite right that they, because I have watched over the years, Jane Kelsey and has always been alerting us to free trade agreements. And I think unless you've got somebody who's actually researching and speaking up about it, we could be left entirely in the dark. And I do believe that when people go off to try and negotiate free trade agreements, they don't even, well, I think in the past they have really taken into consideration the perspective and the views of Māori and what we see as important, and certainly what we don't want to see being given away in terms of, trade-offs.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to agree with you 100% there.
Yes, well, but and I don't know, are there many being negotiated now? I think they're still looking at one with China, I think. That hasn't been finalised, or has it? Well, I suppose they're ongoing. Would they be ongoing?
Yes, they are ongoing, and I'm not fully up to date with all of what's on the calendar, because, as I said, some of it you don't hear about until it's quite well advanced. But Jane would definitely be able to tell you in detail what the state of each and every trade agreement is. I guess because these matters are ongoing, I think part of the significance of the He Whenua Rongo conference was that the only way that we can control our lives is through the things that we do ourselves. So being able to return to how we feed ourselves, where we get our food from, going local, that's totally within our control. A lot of these other issues are quite external, they're quite difficult to get our, get your head around or just get information about. But being able to take care of our families, to keep them out of the systems, be they the health system or the prison system, or the welfare and childcare system, those things are probably the most important acts of passive resistance that we could achieve. And it's within all of us to be able to do that.
Yes, I think you're right. If the best thing we can do is to keep out of the system and not be exposed to, not be exposed to its harmful. That's what I always say after having spent 12 years on a DHB, as a DHB board member. I always thought the best thing you can do for your health is to keep out of the system altogether. So look after your health. And so you won't come into the system because we all know that the system has been broken for some time and it never has served Māori well, that's for sure.
Keep our families safe and strong and well-connected. It's a full-time job. It's not an easy thing to do. There's a lot of distractions that get in the way of being able to achieve that. And not just distractions, but there's a lot of trauma to deal with in terms of the racism that people encounter and the impact that colonization has had. Though people seem to be quite uncomfortable with that word, colonization. Even more uncomfortable with the notion of decolonisation. But we were colonised. That's a statement of fact. It's not just a radical statement or anything. So it was traumatic and we're still in it.
Yes.
So the trauma is very real. And again, at the conference, you could see that through some of the speakers that as they got into the stories they were telling, you know, the tears would start welling up in their eyes because that's how close the trauma is. It's not a distant, abstract thing at all. People feel it on a daily basis.
Yes, they're still living through it. Exactly. Did the was there much discussion and from other countries or from other speakers rather about genetic modification of food and the food system? What are other countries' experiences been like in that area? Is it getting worse in terms of more things are being genetically modified, or is it just it's done its dash and it's not going to be around for much longer, or is it all increasing?
It hasn't proven to be the vanguard that the scientists promised that it would be, you know, in terms of being able to produce these incredible crops that were pest resistant and drought resistant. Like, we haven't actually seen that come to fruition. What we have seen is just a lot of greed by the seed companies to religiously defend the patents that they have on their products. So I think it would be fair to say that GE as a technology in the food space hasn't proven to be all that it was cracked up to be. In some countries, like the US, it's very common. I mean, in New Zealand, we've not had to deal with that issue for a while, but this government has put it back on the table as something that they want to pursue. And that was an issue of concern for people because we know that once you open that gate, you can't close it. It's a decision that impacts not just this generation, but future generations. So we're going to have to see how this plays out in Aotearoa, what kind of processes used to involve Māori and involve the public in general before any decisions are made to allow GEs in New Zealand.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, the good thing is that people are now talking and sharing information and keeping up to date. Tell me, were there many politicians there at all? I would have thought that some might have been interested in it, in the symposium.
I didn't see any of the ones that you would normally see on the 6 o'clock news. So I'd probably say no to that, but there might have been a few who came and went. The thing is, the conference was at capacity. Like they wasn't sold out because you didn't have to pay, but they had a, you know, they had a maximum number, and it was full every single day, all day. That energy I haven't seen at a conference for a very long time. And needless to say, when Vandana Shiva came in, when she addressed the gathering, you could hear a pin drop. Everybody was absolutely fascinated. Because she's a brilliant speaker. She's absolutely brilliant because she brings in philosophy and quantum physics and biology and genetics and then free trade and intellectual property. She weaves it as only someone of that caliber could do in such a wonderful way. It was a real honor to hear her speak. And she spoke three times at that conference. She was given a keynote space for each of the 3 days.
Well, I think that would have, because when I saw that she was speaking, I thought, oh my goodness, that's the woman I see sometimes on, you know, Facebook. I see various clips from where she's been speaking and what she has to say. I like the way she speaks. She's so direct. And I just wonder how she's received in her own country, because sometimes people who do have and she's obviously highly educated, and I wonder sometimes she might be calling her own country to account a wee bit.
She has at times, but I think the main issues around free trade and GE, those are like developing country versus the developed world. Mm-hmm. So in which case she was on side in many cases, because her fight was India's fight.
Yes. And yes. And so, it was for a New Zealand audience, apart from the overseas speakers. It was for a New Zealand audience then.
What kind of audience?
The attendees, they would have been all from New Zealand, apart from the speakers.
The vast majority were. There was a delegation from the Oneida Nation of the Haudenosaunee people in the kind of New York area, the Great Lakes areas around there, and they had four speakers, and they were they gave a really fascinating model which we were all quite transfixed by. They called it the Tribal Elder Food Box, and it is. A local initiative where the indigenous farmers together with local farmers produce these food boxes that include your basic food items as well as indigenous foods, and distribute them across the 11 tribes to the elders. And they started out at 1,200 boxes, and now they're up to 2,330 boxes. And the concept is actually quite fascinating, and it has merit for our situation in Aotearoa, because it's really a return to the local economy. You're getting, say, if you had Māori farmers working together with local farmers to produce these boxes to send out to elders and vulnerable families. It was an incredible process to hear. So we had some people from Australia, Aboriginal people, and others from different countries. But it was mostly New Zealanders, and a very diverse group. But people that are committed to the land.
Mm.